The Black Show Arts Hour on Wandsworth Radio, where you listen with your ears and not your mouth.
Good evening and welcome to the Black Show Arts Hour on Wandsworth Radio. I am Aisha Chapman, and this week on the show, the Blackshaw team are having a little bit of a rest after the excitement that was WAF 2016. We finished up our run of Black Shuck on Thursday night at the Bedford in Balham to a pretty capacity crowd, which was really nice to end the show on that note. But never fear, if you didn't get a chance to come along and see it in its run, then you're in luck. So a few weeks ago, we took our actors along to a recording studio and recorded the whole show for the radio. So keep listening to the Black Show Arts Hour and subscribe to our podcast, of course, as that will be airing later on this year. But coming up on this week's show, I thought I'd take a little bit of a look back at some of the things that we have done over this year. We've got a radio play, a story that we couldn't fit into the on-air broadcast of our Scare Slam, and a very interesting question from regular co-host Helen Johnson. But the first thing that we always do is this.
The Matt Boothman Film Review. So good, I put my trousers back on.
Because it's just me this week, we've organised a very special film review. A few weeks ago, members of the Blackshaw Arts Hour sat down in a room and watched four movies back to back and reviewed them. I'm not going to tell you what all the movies were, because you need to keep listening to the show over the next year to find out. But this one is Nick Tatchell, Matt Boothman, Vicky Weston, sitting in a room and reviewing The Grand Budapest Hotel.
This is a retro movie review with Matt, Nick and Vicky. Good evening.
Evening.
And we've just finished watching The Grand Budapest Hotel, a Wes Anderson movie. And it definitely is a Wes Anderson movie.
It is the most Wes Anderson of all the Wes Anderson movies
he's out there.
He did it out Wes himself, yeah. Before we started watching the film, we talked about some of the things that you expect to see in a classic Wes Anderson movie. And then started pointing them out every time they happened and realised that they were happening 100% of the time.
Yeah, absolutely non-stop.
30 seconds was every single trope.
Nearly every single trope. And the one that I think Matt had mentioned before was, incredibly symmetrical artistic shots. And this film is full of them. Mm. And they are beautiful. Mm.
Shots is the word. I was saying he's a director that makes his movies out of shots rather than out of scenes.
Definitely. Like, yeah.
Every single shot we kept saying like a painting.
Yeah, he's like an artist. He's just setting up these shots. Yeah.
I think that's exactly because each one of them was not only beautiful to look at, but also in this film everything was framed.
Yes.
You kept him going through doors, you kept him going through windows.
Yeah, and he loves the lift, loves the, anything that puts a frame around people. Oh, beautifully done, really, really painterly.
But I think as well, and Vicky, you've seen more of his movies than I have, so you might have a different opinion on this. I think it's, as well as being the most Wes Anderson film, it's also the most accessible. And it's comedic and sort of rollicking in its kind of adventure plot.
Yeah, there's a bit more of a storyline to follow as well. Like, quite a lot of his other ones, you could argue that actually not really. Like, it's so character-driven. Like, The Royal Tenenbaums is a classic, really good character-driven film. But there's not a lot of actual things that happen. It's more about the characters. Like, it's not got a story arc as such, whereas this really does.
It's kind of a caper.
Yeah, it has, A lot of caper elements, definitely.
But I think the way it's introduced, too, you're introduced as a girl approaches an author's bust in a park, and then you learn about the author, and the author addresses you much like Roald Dahl would address you, and then it keeps on layering back, as I just said, like Inception.
Yes.
You're going from one thing to another, and then you learn that actually Wes Anderson's using this author to tell the story that he learned from our main character, Zero, who tells him over a a very symmetrical meal.
Incredibly, incredibly symmetrical dining room in the world's most symmetrical hotel. I think a hotel is the ideal setting for a Wes Anderson film, given his love of symmetry, because they are, like, normally relatively symmetrical places. So you have a lot of, you know, sweeping staircases on both sides or windows that are nice and even. But there were some points where he was able to find a symmetrical shot where I was just like, how long did it take him? Like, how long did they set this shot up for to make sure that it had that symmetry?
Of course, a hotel's usually got its colour scheme and its kind of themed style as well, which lets him do it. I feel like he could be an interior decorator in life.
Yeah, absolutely. I would love for Wes Anderson to decorate me a house. I'd be like, Wes, take your mind, imagine a house, and then just make it happen for me. And I think it would be amazing. Yeah.
And well, a hotel also lends it to farce.
Yeah, for sure.
Opening and closing doors, people going down elevators, people running away from each other. It's classic farce territory.
Yeah.
And I think this is one of his greatest farces.
It's like...
misunderstandings. People not getting the whole story. It's the...
Yeah, it's actually... It is a classic farce. It's just because it was directed by Wes Anderson, it's not like a farce.
No.
I think that's the...
It's not cheesy.
Yeah, it's just not... He strips out all of the cheese and it's all style and aesthetic and this kind of painterly way of setting up things.
And delivered in a really kind of pacey way.
Yeah.
So in terms of the sequencing of the shots and the scenes and the sort of movement through them, but also in terms of the dialogue, everything's very kind of... It's a machine gun rattle out. Especially all of Ralph Fiennes' parts.
Yeah. And while we're on the subject, Ralph Fiennes in this film.
I've never seen him do a comic performance before.
Yeah, I was saying the closest thing I could think of is his character in Bruges. Have you guys seen that?
Yeah.
But in that, he's a nutcase. Like, he's scary, but funny. But here, he's charming, and he's light, and he's charming, and he's witty.
And he's a complete dandy.
Yes.
Yeah.
Yes, beautifully portrayed dandy.
Just he'd throw every now and then in darling.
Yes.
Yeah. In a quite inappropriate way.
Yeah. Oh, yeah. There's a bit where he turns up after someone's died to the reading of the will, and someone mentions his name and says, like, who is this Monsieur Gustave? And he says, oh, that's me, darling. And it's, like, such an inappropriate, it's wonderful.
And, like, he calls the Gestapo who raided his train, darling.
Yes, yeah.
France, my dear boy.
France, darling, yes. He's guessing the Gestapo guy's name and then calls him darling subsequently. Yeah. It's brilliant. But it's his, like... You know, I guess it was that capturing of, you know, a really good hotelier who people... And it's mentioned, isn't it, that people come back to the hotel for him, not for the hotel. Mm. That you have somebody with that personality, that charm, who is putting your needs above their own and who makes you feel special.
So he's dandyish through all of it, but will occasionally drop a really beautifully placed F-bomb.
Yeah, so many swear words,
And in the same way, the whole movie is kind of, there's a whimsical feel to it, but there are occasional completely sort of gasping, brutal moments.
Yes,
as well.
Yeah, it's quite stark. It really is. The violent stuff is really, you're kind of sort of bewildered and shaking your head,
really,
because you're like, how has this happened? Let's talk about some of the cameos in the film.
Yeah.
As always, in a Wes Anderson...
Bill Murray cameo.
Yeah, for a while, I thought you'd lied to me and he wasn't going to show up. Because it's like, we're 80% of the way through the film and I'm like, no Bill Murray, what's going on?
Owen Wilson. In the shortest cameo.
But so well delivered.
So good.
It's not a Wes Anderson film unless Owen and Bill have turned up, is it? Like, it just isn't. Yeah. Oh, that was good.
Tilda Swinton was amazing.
Tilda Swinton is like an 80-something-year-old woman.
Yeah.
Marvellous.
Yeah.
So good.
Looking completely decrepit.
Yeah.
But he's got, like, it's just the pull of Wes Anderson, I think, is that, you know, he can get really, really good people into...
And I remember that's how they advertised it. They took out massive double billboards all around the city with the hotel in the middle and just every single cameo in a little mugshot around the outside. Mm.
And you're just looking at it going, how much money did this film have to spend?
Yeah.
What? Crazy.
Yeah, it's just a beautiful film to watch.
Yeah, beautifully.
Everything about the colour... The costume, the design. I mean, the location manager must be one of that Wes uses a lot, because he completely understands the theme of the film. He understands what Wes likes, and that the hotel that they actually do it in, you see it in its kind of former glory, and then you see it in its kind of dishevelled,
slightly 70s-y,
60s, 70s, yeah. Kind of yellow and plastic.
Yeah. I'd be really interested to know how much of that was shot on location, actually, because obviously some of the locations that they've got
are completely...
They have to be, because I just can't imagine they're real, you know. Like this funicular that goes up to the hotel, I'm like, if that exists in real life, I want to ride on it, because it looks ridiculous, you know. And it's like, I'm assuming a lot of it's, but you know, everything's taken kind of heavy inspiration from you know, kind of like German schlosses and the kind of Eastern European forests and mountains, and it's really like it's quite spectacular.
Yeah. Picturesque.
Yes, it is picturesque. And that's obviously, I guess, what he wanted. But it still has all of the real great, like, rounded character stuff that you would expect in a good Wes Anderson movie as well.
Yeah, and I think it, when you were saying it was more accessible, I think that's because we completely understand all the characters really quickly, other than, like, his other films where you actually have to spend time getting to understand them, and they're slightly odd and... quirky. I mean, they're odd and quirky, but in a kind of very open and honest way. It's not as Wes Anderson in that respect.
Yeah.
Is that anything to do with the narration? Is that something that he uses in a lot in his other movies?
There is narration in...
Because the narration does give you a little intro, especially to Monsieur Gustave, so it gives you a rundown of what he's like.
I'm trying to think which ones have narration now.
Fantastic Mr. Fox
does. I don't think Royal Tenenbaums or any of the really early ones do. So it's obviously something that he maybe started using. Because it's a great story. It is a great storytelling device. And Jude Law and Tom Wilkinson play the two ages of the same person and do it very well. And it's nice to have those little flashes of narration kind of reminding you that you're in that story. But then F. Murray Abraham, who plays Zero Mustafa, our kind of would-be hero... as an old man telling the writer the story, so many layers, is then part-time narrator as well. Yeah. So he's messing around with who's the real like narrator of the story is quite interesting.
So a caper and funny, and but also there's a lot of poignancy in it, sort of poignancy for faded glory of places and for... missing people as well.
And the idea that, you know, that people are tied to a place and tied to a time, and that's quite like, well, it is well explored in the movie.
Because you could, talking about all the sort of the visual tropes, you could be forgiven for thinking that this is that it's a bit surface.
Yes,
but there definitely is a strong emotional thread to it that definitely catches and pulls at you by the end.
Yeah, definitely. It's a really good film, actually. I'm sorry it's taken me this long to see it, quite frankly.
Yeah.
But yeah, big...
worth it.
Definite recommendation for us. If you've never seen a Wes Anderson film before, it's definitely a good one to start with. There's definitely no order to see them in. And as Matt says, probably his most accessible storyline-wise. So yeah, great place to start.
At the beginning of this year, Blackshaw did a 3-week run of Staying Alive at the Pleasance in Islington. We created a whole bunch of content surrounding the show, from interviewing the cast and speaking with members of child bereavement charities. However, one of the silliest bits of content we made was Helen Johnson asking the cast and crew about whether or not they have ever felt like they have too many arms. Here she is.
Hello, Rachel.
Hello, Helen.
How are you?
I'm good, thanks. How are you doing?
I'm good, yeah. How are you enjoying the run?
Very much so, having a great time.
Excellent. Right, that is all well and good, but I've got a really important question to ask you.
Go on.
Right, when you're rehearsing a show, or when you're on stage, so like when you're in the space and you're in character, do you ever feel like you've got too many arms?
Yes.
Can you expand on that at all?
Well, now that you've actually put that suggestion in my head, I realise that at the times when I'm sitting on stage and at one moment I'm holding a glass, another moment I'm touching my face, and suddenly for a third moment I'm also scratching my leg. I don't know how that happens, but somehow it does. Therefore, I have too many arms.
That's very interesting. Thank you very much.
You're more than welcome.
Too many arms.
Too many arms.
Limbs.
Yes.
I can't say I often come...
I sometimes feel like
I don't know what to do with all the extraneous parts of my body, which I think might be what that the kind of behind the context of that question is.
Yeah.
Ah.
So too many arms, I think, does kind of...
Sometimes two feels like too many.
Yes, because what do you do with the arms? How do you hold them? Where do you put them? What does it say about your character by the way you're moving them? It's awkward. I think particularly at the stage where you've just put your script down.
Yes.
If you've just gone off book, what do you do with your hands that have previously been holding the script?
Yeah, I think it's hard to realise that you actually do move your hands quite a lot in real life, so it's okay to do that on stage because that's quite realistic. And just being unconscious of your physical movement, like being comfortable in your body and how it moves.
I had a really important question for you.
Which is...
when you're rehearsing or when you're on stage, sometimes do you feel like you've got too many arms?
Yes, I did have an instance with that tonight where you're just like, where am I putting my hands today? Which is often why you get people going, what can I hold on to? So it's really nice when someone like gives you a glass of wine, you can hold that and you can put your other hand in your pocket, because otherwise you're standing there with your hands in your pockets and you're like, should I have my hands in my pockets? Should I have my hands on my hips? And you just don't know where to put them. So it's maybe not so much a case of too many arms, it's just the two that I've got are too many.
Okay.
Does that answer your question?
Really good to know. Thank you very much.
Okay, no worries.
Do I ever feel like I've got too many arms?
Yeah, too many arms.
No, I don't.
That's good.
Yeah, it is. It is. Unless I was playing, like, you know, the octopus in, I don't know, a remake of Beatles song, video, whatever. I don't know.
But then wouldn't you have too few arms?
Well, you've got me there. Yeah, I would, yeah.
Thank you very much for answering. I'm not going to talk to you anymore.
Okay, good.
I've got a really important question for you about acting.
Go on.
Right, so when you're rehearsing or when you're performing, when you're in the space,
yep.
Do you ever feel like you've got too many arms?
Too many arms?
Too many arms.
Are we talking guns or actual arms? Do you know what? Never felt that.
Have you ever felt like you've had too many guns on stage?
Oh, now we're going for the weaponry.
Well, you brought it up.
It depends on the piece. And by piece, I don't mean, like, you know, what piece am I packing? I mean the theatrical piece.
I feel like that conversation could go a long way.
Hello.
I have a really important question for you.
Great, good.
Are you ready for the important question?
Yeah, I'm ready now.
Good, right. So when you're rehearsing or you're performing, so you're in the space, do you ever feel like you've got too many arms?
No.
Don't you?
No.
That was Helen asking the age-old question, do you feel like you ever have too many arms? If you do, as always, we'd love to hear about it. You can find us on Facebook by googling Blackshaw Theatre, or you can follow us on Twitter at Blackshaw Update. Next up is a story that Richard Stratton, Blackshaw's resident internet genius and New Writing Night photographer, read out at the Scare Slam last year. Now, Richard was very brave and was the only person on the night that got up and told his spooky story off the cuff. Here he is at the Horse and Stables in Lambeth, talking about his spookiest experience.
I'm Richard. I was doing the sound. I was recording everything. And then Alison earlier was telling a story about this girl that she saw, and it reminded me of something. In fact, it reminded me of three things that have happened at different points in my life, which, like, I was listening to your story, and I was like, because I had the headphones in, so in some ways, I have had an even more intimate experience than any of you. Your pains at kicking, particularly, ow. So I was listening to this, and I'm afraid I didn't hear parts of your story because, like a puzzle in my mind, these things were coming back to me. And so kind of three, and I will try and keep them short, stories. One, amusing, because I was small, and what seems scary then is really not scary now. One that I now realise at a young age perhaps was quite more... perhaps I was a little more insightful than a 6 to 8 year old probably should have been. And then one that happened 2 years ago that I didn't combine with everything else, which is now going to make me a little scared when I go to sleep. So thank you. So first story. I'm around 6 or 8, and I had a nightmare, as many 6 to 8 year olds do, I suppose. And this particular nightmare, and I'm not entirely sure where this came from, as I'm sure most people that have nightmares, you know, you can kind of guess where maybe some of these scary images came from, but honestly, other than I went to a shop, I don't understand where this was. The nightmare was essentially me in a supermarket. And instead of produce being scanned, members of my family were being scanned by this devilish kind of woman who it's funny because the more I think about it, the more vivid it becomes and how things kind of stick in your head. But this devilish woman that was part of the scan, like the whole setup of the shop, she wasn't sitting on the chair, she was part of the chair, like she was rooted to the ground. And she was just, she picked up my sister and beep. And I can't remember what she turned into, but she turned into something. And that scared me. And I remember being at the end of this, of the kind of queue of my family, as though we were all lining up not to have our shopping scanned, but to be scanned. And so, beep, there goes my sister, and she turns into something. And then my mother, and she goes, beep, and she, I remember this, she turns into a chair, which, although isn't a particularly scary object, freaked the out of me, because my mother was suddenly a chair and she's just kind of placed in the bagging area. Like, and although this was not a thing, but I was thinking of this, and all I could think was unusual item in the bagging area. And then my dad comes along, beep, and he becomes a haystack, which is slightly more weird and slightly more scary, because I don't know, this chair like was a recognizable object, but haystacks, I grew up in the country, but still it was kind of weird. And then it was me, and then I turned up and I went beep, and I turned into Uncle Fester from the Addams Family. And then I ran from the store as the only suddenly animate object in there, still human and with legs. And I ran and I joined the Addams Family and looked out of a window down this winding road towards the supermarket, I presume, where all my family had been turned into things, and just kind of stared mournfully as Fester at the place where my sister had been turned into something I can't remember, and my mother had become a chair and my father had become a haystack. And then I woke up in a cold sweat and just like screamed. It was my first memory of being truly terrified as a child, and as an adult I find it quite funny. And I remember like explaining this to my parents, and they were like, oh, there's nothing to be scared of, it was just a dream. It wasn't in the real world, this is never going to happen. You know, we can't become chairs and haystacks, and that was fine. And I went to sleep the nights knowing that, okay, yeah, there's this separation, right, between nightmares, between dreams, and between reality. And for several years, that was fine. And it was perhaps like I feel like I was scared of nightmares, but I could deal with them, right? I could wake up and I can go, that was a nightmare, that wasn't real, that's fine. Like, I would call for mum and she'd go, it was a nightmare. And I'd go, okay, that's fine, that was a nightmare. And that was fine for several years. And it was probably maybe 12, 13, like early teenage at best. And I remember clear as day, and I'll preface this with, I don't believe in ghosts, right? I love scary stories, I like fear, but I am the most skeptic person you will probably find. Like, if someone says they're psychic, like, that is the reaction I have. But I woke up, and I was lying in like this single bed, and there was my desk here, and there were these my shelves here with my CD player, with my cassette tape, because I'm also old, of audiobooks, Harry Potter, in there. I used to go to sleep with those. And I looked up, and if you could imagine, just kind of waking up, like, on your back, which is a weird thing, I think, because usually I wake up on the side, or, like, not like you're in a coffin, that kind of like proper on your back, straight up, as though you've been positioned there. And right above me, I saw this woman in a rocking chair floating like maybe 2-3 feet above me, knitting. And I remember just waking up and going, okay, right, I know about nightmares. Those are the things that happen when you're asleep. But now I'm in my room and I know I'm awake and I can see this woman floating at me. But that's probably fine because this is probably some sort of hallucination. I've come out of a dream and this has followed me out of my dream. And I'm kind of, all this is going through my head in this kind of split second. And I've pretty much rationalized it and like, no, this is not real. And I'm staring up at her, still kind of in this kind of coffin, kind of as I've been laid out to be buried, and then I hate her. Then she looks at me, fucking looks at me and smiles. And in that second, I'm like, no, I can't rationalize this. It was for a second this kind of image, this floating apparition in front of me. But now there is eye contact. This is real. And again, I freaked the out again. My parents both, which is very rare because usually it's one or the other, right? Because one of them goes, oh God, it's your turn, he's you know, playing up again or whatever. But no, they clearly, this was such an extreme outburst of I don't know what, of fear, of emotion, of whatever, that they come dashing into my room like, what is it? And I was like, there was this woman. And again, like the first time since I had that talk about the haystacks and everything, the first time since that moment, I had to sit with my parents and go, okay, this still wasn't real. Like, we don't know, like, whatever it was, whatever happened, this wasn't real. She wasn't there. It was fine. You were dreaming. You woke up. It was just your imagination, you know. Women do not sit in rocking chairs knitting above you. It's like 12-year-old kids. And then when they wake up, look down at them, smile, and then apparently disappear. This isn't a thing that happens to people, although, of course, to me at that point, it had happened to me. But again, even as a 12-year-old perhaps skeptic, I was like, yes, no, this can't be... There is better explanations. The haystack happened in a dream. Lady can happen outside of a dream for that few seconds it happened. And I went back to sleep and everything was fine until 2 years ago. I went to California for work for 2 years. 2 years, 2 weeks. Felt like 2 years. No, I went there and so I was in this hotel. And I was like, jet lag is a thing. Obviously, you wake up right middle of the night, 3 o'clock or whatever. And so I hadn't got into the whole thing of when I should wake up. So I wake up, and there was no dream. I think there may have been with the old lady, and obviously there was for the haystack. But there was no dream. I just woke up, and it was a very peaceful. I woke very peacefully. It wasn't a sudden, you know, when you're asleep and then suddenly you're awake. And that's usually what you have with a nightmare, right, or a dream. It's like there's this sudden transition between seeing this one reality and then coming back to what's real. And that didn't happen. I kind of came out of it as though you would if you were naturally waking up. It was kind of very gentle, and I kind of felt my eyes kind of open. And if you can imagine waking up and seeing somebody like right here, like if you were to turn to the person next to you right now and close your eyes and then they move towards you at kind of a distance that you weren't expecting, and then after a few seconds you open your eyes and you see that person like right there, like those big eyes, and you like, but now imagine you didn't realize you were sitting next to someone and you didn't know your eyes were closed. That's what, like, I woke up and right, maybe as I look at the mic now, great, again, great radio, but probably like here, like there, like, I don't know, about a foot or something, there was this face. And it was this, it's kind of, I'm pretty sure it's like a young girl probably, and this is why your story reminded me of this. And it was kind of something I put in the back of my, even though it happened 2 years ago, it's really weird. But she just was there, right? As though she was kneeling at my bedside, just like dead in my eyes. Like she was really, like she was looking at me before I woke up. Like she was watching me sleep. And I remember waking up and having that same, okay, this is happening. And there was this memory of this woman. I was like, okay, it's just this woman. She'll go away. And she was still there. And I don't know what time passed in this thing. It's kind of unknown to me, but it felt like a good long time where we were just looking at each other, and it was just like this constant eye contact. And she didn't really do anything. She just stood there like passive. Like there was no smile, there was no real emotion, which kind of made it weirder, because if someone's watching you sleep, they're either watching you sleep because like maybe it, I don't know, it gets them off, or because they have some sort of horrible ulterior motive where they're going to like do something for you, but you expect an emotion, you expect some sort of something, whether it be God knows of the gamut of emotions there are, but it wasn't any of them. It was just kind of like, I am here and I am watching you sleep, and now you've woken up and neither of us know what to do. And in that moment, I thought, I know what I'll do. And I reached out. And I was like, whether it was conscious or whether it was some sort of instinct, it was like, I need to know if this is actually something that's happening to me. And I just tried to touch her. I tried to like see if I could put my hand on her face. It was my right arm, because I was on my side. And I kind of reached out and tried to touch her, and my hand just kind of went, phew. And I thought, okay, this is kind of weird, because surely if this isn't happening and this is a dream, the moment that happens, my body's going to go, surprise, it wasn't real, and she'd disappear. But I put my hand through her, and it went, through it goes, and... And there was just, and again, this could have literally happened within the space of 5 seconds or so, but to me it felt like a lifetime. But hand goes through, and there's the passive face, and really this is what I'm remembering now, because I remembered the experience of the girl, but it wasn't until your story that I remembered all of this, and it kind of came back. And it was this passive expression went to kind of this inquisitive look, as though this was something she had done many times before and had never received a reaction of, I'm going to try to touch you. Like it was, she was expecting fear or just like, oh, go away. Or something, it was just this weird, oh. And it was that her expression matched what I felt when it was that, okay. It was exactly that, to me at least, it seemed like another couple of seconds of this intense eye contact, and then she just went away, and I freaked out in this sudden moment, and I thankfully at the age of 26, and I suppose as a 26-year-old man, I did the very manly thing of turning all the f***ing lights on that I could find. Like and it's a hotel, right? So you're not entirely sure where the light switches are. So there's this comment moment of me running around, and I hit a light switch, and the bathroom light goes on. I'm like, that's not the light I want. And I find all these lights, and I kind of sit there. And it was a twin room. I'd been put in a twin room for some reason. So I was sat there in one bed where there's this other bed that before this girl had been stood in front of, and I could see this bed beyond her. And I was sat on this bed looking at this empty bed and looking at this empty gap where this girl had been. And I was kind of left in this situation of, how do I go to sleep now? What do I do? What was this? And I didn't have, like, the other two times, this is... The stories kind of combine in a tenuous way. I'd been able to call out for someone, right? There'd been somebody there, in both instances, my parents, to rationalise this for me and say, no, it was okay. And I was left in this situation where that was up to me now, for the first time in my life, when I had been really, truly terrified. Like, there'd been times outside of dreams that I had been terrified. But this was the first... But there'd always been someone there, and this was the first time. It was just me in a different country, in a hotel, in a room that I did not know, with nobody else there to share this experience with, or to talk about it, or to try and, as I say, rationalize it. And it was just down to me. And I managed it just. I am still a skeptic. I still don't believe in ghosts. Like, I really don't. I know, like, there's the you know, the succubus and the thing, the night terrors, and the people would wake up and this, they would have this presence pressing down their chest. And there's science and there's reasons and there's many wonderful, but they stick those things on your heads and those little wiggly lines go on the monitors and they go, that there, that bit of electricity is telling me why this happened. And all these things went through my head. But yet, despite the fact that if anyone asked me, are there ghosts? Thanks to that story and all of those things that have just come up, tonight I will be a little bit scared when I go to sleep, because whether it be haystacks or floating ladies in rocking chairs, or really, really scary girls at my bedside, I'm not entirely sure what I'm going to wake up to. And that's my story.
Fantastic. It's always good. Richard Stratton?
Yes.
Yes, excellent. Thank you very much. Thank you. Thank you for your candor and your willingness to unburden that, like, you know, with no provocation. So that's good. Okay, so we're now at the stage.
That was a live recording from our first ever Scare Slam last year at the Horse and Stables. The night was such a great success, and we enjoyed doing it so much that potentially we'll be doing another one later on this year, so stay tuned and we'll let you know how to be involved in that. Now, as you may know, we have a regular new writing night every other month at the Horse and Stables in Lambeth. Our next one is at the end of July, and the best thing about these nights is not only seeing great new writing on stage, but also that we get to record the pieces. So if you can't make it along, you have the possibility of hearing about them on the radio, just like this next piece. This is Beige, written by Dan Weatherer.
Sunset. A sparse living room set, comprising of a big chair, a side table, and of course a telephone. Milton is standing behind the chair. He is holding a blood-soaked kitchen knife, and his shirt and face is splashed with blood. Gail is sitting on the sofa. As soon as the lights come up, she sits on her side. Milton turns and looks at Gail.
Did it? Didn't see that one coming, did you? Miss High and Mighty, Miss Know-It-All! Not the way. You know what they do to you in prison? You'll be passed around like currency.
Milton pulls up his t-shirt.
There's only one way. One thing to do, old buddy.
And as he pulls up his t-shirt, he places the tip of a blade against his skin.
Come on now. Just like a samurai!
You must tell me just what the hell that was all about.
Gail?
You've only got a damn it this time, haven't you?
Gail?
Don't you Gail me.
shut your pots.
Did you really think I was going to let you kill me and not have my say about it? You really don't know me at all, do you, Milton Moore? Don't you look at me in that tone. You keep your hands to yourself. Don't you get any ideas about having your way with me now?
Good woman, what do you think I am?
Well, I thought I knew. After tonight's antics, you really surprised me. Come on, then. Out with it.
Out with what?
Why you did it. What have I done to warrant this, then? I mean, I know at the end of all this, it'll be your fault, but, you know, let's hear it anyway.
I thought you were having an affair.
How? I haven't got time to have an affair. I'm spending all my time busy cleaning up after you.
I thought you were having one online. You're always in those chat rooms, talking to people. I see you smirking to yourself when you read something you like. I'm thinking you are going to meet up with one of your mystery men and leave me.
Not bloody likely. The internet's full of weirdos.
So what were you doing?
I was bored, okay? You never talked to me, it was just a bit of fun.
How many were there?
Just one.
Did you send him?
I did, yeah. Several, actually.
Oh my God! I knew it! I bloody knew it!
They weren't of me, though.
What do you mean? They weren't of me, were they? I mean, there's all sorts of fruitcakes on the internet.
Oh, get over yourself. They weren't of you. I'm not sure who they were of. I just found them online. I mean, I wasn't going to go to all that effort tidying myself up for some weirdo on the
internet. Okay. Then what about all those different colognes that I've been spending on?
I told you. Male fragrances are much cheaper than female these days. I thought I was trying to save you money, and yet I'm in the wrong again.
So you weren't having an affair?
No.
Oh,
indeed. See? I said it would be your fault, was I right? Was I ever?
Yes, you were.
So you killed me over your misinterpretation of the facts?
Yes, but...
Don't you think a conversation would have been more appropriate instead of some overtly grand and, in my case, fatal gesture?
Yes, but...
why didn't you? I mean, I'm always saying to you...
Because I can never get a word in!
Well, then there's no point interrupting, is there?
No, it's not.
So what's the plan now then, genius? How are you going to get out of this little pickle?
Seppuku.
Seppu what?
It means stomach cutting. It's the way of a dishonored samurai who commits suicide.
Give me strength.
Only I couldn't do it.
Why not?
I can't. You know I have a deep-rooted fear of hell.
Where do you think butchering me is going to get you? Funny you've already punched that ticket. I tell you what, give my dad a call. He'll be straight round to do it for you when you tell him what you've done.
Oh yeah. I wondered how long it would be until you brought your dad to this.
I was merely offering his help. You haven't the stones to offer yourself, so let him do it for you.
Because, of course, he'd do a much better job of it than I would, right?
Oh, I doubt. Do you want his number?
No.
57.
I'm not calling your father.
Of course you aren't. You're intimidated by him.
No, I'm not.
Yes, you are. You are intimidated by him because he's a man's man. He knows things that men should know and you don't.
So we fix our boiler that one time. Doesn't qualify him as an expert in all things, does it? Besides, he must be lacking
say?
Nothing. You can't say anything. It's the blood in all your ears.
Yeah, it's like that.
So we're back to blame again, are we?
Yes, we are back to blame again. Let me ask you this question. Have I murdered you lately?
No.
Sorry, what was that?
No.
Well, as murder seems to be the hot topic tonight, and I'm the only one lying dead, I'll apportion as much blame as I see fit. Thank you very much. So now what?
I don't know.
Well, you can forget about dismembering me in the bathtub and leaving me out for the bin then. I look terrible in black.
Oh, I wasn't planning to. I remember Artley's funeral. I've never seen PVC stretch so far as to become transparent.
Oh, bloody cheek. That cost you £350. So, what now? That's always been your problem. No foresight. You failed to plan.
You plan to fail.
Yes, yes, son of.
It's a bloody good job you never gave me any kids. They'd be mortified to find out their daddy was capable of exoricide.
Huh?
It means the act of stabbing your wife with a kitchen knife.
Oh. Oh, why do you have to bring in my weak swimmers into this, eh? I told you! It's the stress of work that does it. It's not my fault. I always wanted children.
Well, so did I. But you couldn't even manage that. And don't go bringing work into this again. I suppose you never even gave your work a second thought in all of this. I mean, think of all the press attention you're going to bring as a foremost supplier of kitchen utensils. Hardly. Hardly going to bring them the sort of attention they want. See? Only thinking of yourself. Typical Milton, all self, self, self.
I don't care. They never valued me. I'm middle management. Strike one down, and there are two more all ready to take their place. I won't be missed.
Well, you should care. You'll need a good reference of them when you get out. If you get out.
Out?
Of jail.
I'm not going to jail! This was a crime of passion!
Passion? I'm here first.
It was. Misinformed though I was, I killed you. So nobody else could have you.
Oh. Oh, you're very thoughtful. It's a pity I didn't get to say the matter.
Besides, nobody knows you're dead. Not yet. I can still hide your body. You just shut up long enough to let me think!
And let me get this straight. So you want me to hold my tongue whilst you think of a way to dispose of my remains?
You would, please.
How about acid? Or lime?
Not sure where to get that from. This hour.
You could burn me.
It's raining
now.
Look. Can you just shut up so I can...
I was only trying to help.
Did it hurt? Wait. Stabby.
Bloody hell, what is this? 20 questions?
I just always wonder. That's all, I just...
Okay. It's kind of like the colour beige.
Beige? Is that it?
Starting to smell, aren't I?
Just a little.
Perhaps you should make that call.
I give myself up.
Yeah, why not? First offence, crime of passion and all that. You'll probably get off with a fine and a stern warning telling you not to do it again.
You think so?
Oh, God, yeah. The courts are so plugged up with real crimes these days. Things like this are brushed under the carpet all the time.
You might be right.
I am right. I'm always right. The way I've been prattling on tonight, I bet I had it coming anyway.
Yes, yes, you did. You so did.
So make the call. And an ambulance. Wait, do ambulances take dead bodies? Oh. Okay. No, she's gone. What happened? I stabbed her! 6, I think. 7. 7, it was 7, the neck, remember?
No, sorry, my mistake. 7. It was 7. I forgot the one to the neck. Yes, it was my wife. How did you guess? Wait, have you met my wife before?
You've just listened to Beige, written by Dan Weatherer, directed by Catherine Lord. Milton was played by Richard Mulado, and Gail was played by Hayley Mary Axe, recorded live. Now, that brings us to the end of this solo show for me for another week. Don't forget to follow us on Twitter at Blackshire Update and subscribe to this podcast to never miss an episode. We're on iTunes as the Blackshire Arts Hour. My co-hosts will be back in a fortnight, and we'll be bringing you more radio plays from our new writing nights. Matt will be back film reviewing, and we might even have an arts thing of the week. Thanks for listening, and we'll be back with you again in 2 weeks' time. Stay tuned for the Cheese Board.